Good evening. So, as you know, our practice is based on selflessness, but its meaning is sometimes is often misunderstood. The selflessness. If we take it too seriously, then we consciously try to be selfless, and that doesn't work. To try to be selfless, it's very difficult to be selfless when you're trying to do it, because there are traces of selfishness in that very idea of trying to be selfless. So if we are moved or we are touched, if we are inspired by the whole idea of selflessness and feel this, that's the right way to be, that's the right way to live, there's no technique that will help us. And we may try a variety of things, but we won't be successful. Selflessness is not something that we can have by, you know, trying. Selflessness has to be present before we try anything. Selflessness is not something that we can be aware of. You know, if you try to get selflessness, you will always be saying, "Do I have it? Don't I have it? Why don't I have it?" So, selflessness is not something that we can be aware of. But at the same time, it's necessary to understand. Necessary to understand it and to know how difficult it is to understand it. So if you've read the biography of Suzuki Roshi, Crooked Cucumber, I know many of you have read it. It's a delightful book. And in the beginning of the book, it talks about how the little little Suzuki, little boy. He and some other young boys were living with the teacher, Soan Roshi. And there's a story about how one day they were cleaning a pond, cleaning worms out of a pond with the other boys, the other disciples. And little Suzuki picked up a goldfish that had a small worm in it. And he had learned about this worm in school. And so he very proudly said, "I have it. This is the Nijinko worm, everybody." And Soan said, "Shut up." You know that story? Soan said, "Shut up." To this little kid. So at the time, the young Suzuki, he didn't know why Soan shouted at him. "Why should he shout at me?" But later he understood. He understood why. He came to understand that when Soan shouted at him when he was a little boy, when he was a little boy showing pride, the shouting was mercy, was merciful. Soan was always watching his boys. He was always watching his disciples to see if they were selfish or were developing selfish habits. So any bit of pride or any action that would call attention to yourself or to themselves, he would scold them and say, shut up. He wanted to kill in them any notion of selfishness. He's tried to encourage being selfless. So we know that a selfish attitude can create arrogance. It will create arrogance when we are selfish. Because an arrogant attitude is based on selfish ideas. So when we are selfish, even in the most subtle way, not explicitly selfish, but you know, in our heart, selfish, we are being arrogant. So on, always watched out for arrogance in his students. The usual display of arrogance we all recognize. It's easy to recognize arrogance. Somebody will be very pushy, will show off, be very demanding. But there are also subtle forms of arrogance, and they are sometimes difficult to recognize. An example of this kind of subtle arrogance is when we are faced with a task, or somebody asks us to do something, and we know we have the time, and we know we have the capacity, and we know we have the resource, and yet we say, oh, no, I can't do that. No, I don't know how to help you. Oh, I don't have time. When we know we can make the time. That's a kind of arrogance. I'm too busy. When, if we are unselfish, we know we can make the time to help a friend or just to be helpful. I can make the time. But when we say such things as, well, no, I can't, I don't have the time, it's really a cover-up for saying, I don't want to, which is, you know, a little bit selfish. Oh, I don't want to. So that's the kind of tendency that Soan wanted to make sure his disciples didn't have. Our practice, a Zen practice, puts emphasis on what is known as self-power. In Buddhist terms, self-power. In other words, we do something ourselves with our own effort. So there are other Buddhist schools that rely on what's known as other power, such as the Buddhist school that asks the Amida Buddha for help. Other power. The power is there, you know, somewhere. Ask Amida Buddha for help. And these schools are based on the idea that we, human beings, are sinful creatures and we need outside help for our salvation. So the teachers of these other schools emphasized a very subtle kind of arrogance in people. Because if we feel, you know, I need Amida Buddha for my salvation, I can't do it because I am sinful. This is a kind of arrogance. Oh, I can't do it. Help me. I can't make that effort. And when we have that, if we were to have that kind of attitude, it means everyone is sinful, including me. And this other Buddha needs to be our refuge in our sinfulness. So, Zen school has a bit of a different orientation. So our attitude is, even though I may be sinful now, or maybe I'm arrogant now, or maybe I'm selfish now, through my practice, I can go beyond that. When we have this kind of determination, I know my limitation, I know my karma, I know what I have to work on. When we have this kind of determination, then we know the real meaning of practice. And then we will sit in Zazen. Then we sit without any problem of having an idea of gaining anything. I'm here to dissolve my sinfulness or my arrogance. So we sit without concern for gaining anything, and that includes gaining selflessness. I'm just going to work on myself. If we try various techniques or ways to be free from selfish ideas, eventually we'll give up trying various techniques, and at that point we become ready to just sit. It's the Buddha story of Buddha. And he left the castle and went out into the world and studied with various, the most famous yoga teachers of his day. There were six. And he tried them all in turn. And they each had a different technique, a different take on how to be free from suffering. And he tried each one. And after a while he said, I give up. I give up on this technique or that technique or the other technique of these famous people. And he just went out there and he just sat down. Famously sat down under the Bodhi tree without any technique, without any idea. Just, I give up on all that. And he was ready to just sit. The same thing is true for us. Just and give up all the techniques, just sit. When people discuss religion, the subject of conscience usually comes up somewhere, talking about religion. We say that having a conscience is the motivation for acting unselfishly. With conscience, we aren't selfish. But even though we may have a very strong and sincere conscience, if there are any traces of selfishness, it will be a struggle. There'll be a battle, because the part of us that's still selfish will say, I want to do this. Oh, but my conscience is telling me to do that. So there'll be a struggle. So real conscience, to have a total, sincere, real conscience, is beyond what we can discuss. or even think about. If our conscience is like that, then we won't struggle with ourself. There will be no conflict. It seems like this is a very, very strict viewpoint. But when we are strict with ourselves in this way, our real conscience can appear. As Suzuki Roshi said, thinking about the episode with Soan, he said that Soan's strictness was merciful. If we seek for something outside ourselves, like the truth or some kind of understanding, we can't find out what it is. But when we are strict with ourselves, when we kind of scold ourselves when we know we have strayed towards selfishness, then we can find out what we really need. We don't really need what we are being selfish about. But if we notice our tendency to be selfish for something, when we are strict with ourselves, maybe even scold ourselves a little bit, then we know what it is we really need. And it's not what is the desire of our selfishness. So instead of becoming attached to something that we hear or something that we see, we have to feel the impulse from inside. We have to feel the impulse that's within us, which becomes the basis for everything. When we feel the impulse from ourselves, coming from ourselves, then we become very grateful for our life. This is what's known as Buddha nature, this gratitude. This is an expression of Buddha nature. So, to be selfish means to attach or cling to something that we can see or something that we can understand intellectually. And when we do that, we will forget what it is that supports the understanding, or the color we see, or the shape we see, or the sound we hear. We will forget what supports it, what gives us life. So when we see a flower, or a friend, or the bird, and we admire it and it gives us pleasure. If we understand its source, then there's real joy. But if we forget what supports the bird or the flower, then we will not be one. We will not be intimate with the friend or the flower. And we will become attached to it and want it for ourselves. And when we attach to it, we cannot have a direct and intimate relationship with the bird or the flower. And we will create a barrier. So it's vital that we appreciate the source, the basis of everything in our life. And that is the meaning of true love, to appreciate the source of something we admire, to appreciate more than the attractiveness of it, or him or her, beyond the attractiveness or the part that gives us pleasure, to appreciate where it comes from, appreciate its source. Then we are intimate with it, and then we really appreciate it without attaching to it, without a selfish idea. The unselfish mind sees our life as practicing with others, even though others may never have heard of this practice. We are practicing with each other, even though others don't know about us or practice. This is what we can call Zen in everyday life. We are practicing with others. If we have that attitude, there can be nothing selfish in it. But if we can't do that, if we can't feel that we're practicing with everybody and everything, then the meaning of Zazen becomes elusive. We can't quite grasp it. So when we sit here in the morning, quietly in Zazen, and various sounds come to our ear, let them come, and we don't discriminate, and we don't judge, and we just hear it. We just accept it. The same thing is true in our everyday life, in maybe even a difficult and stressful work situation. If someone is saying something to us, whatever it is, it's instructive. Even if we're being criticized. There is a story that was told. An incident that happened in the very early days of Kanando, before it was known as Kanando, and in the days when Katagiri Roshi was here and visiting. So the story is that a woman went to Katagiri and complained about a friend who she went to visit in the hospital. Then she complained to Katagiri that this woman she visited just kept talking. She wouldn't be quiet. Just kept talking. And the woman complained to Katagiri about the other woman, and Katagiri said, you should listen to everybody. So we should let go of judging situations like that according to our own preferences. If somebody is talking, let them talk. And just listen. Maybe there's something there. That kind of practice helps us get rid of selfish ideas. We should listen to everybody, whether it's critical or not, or whether it's pleasant or not, we should listen to everybody. And we should try not to become too fussy about things, or we will lose the feeling of our practice. And there's no real need to discuss things in any great length. If we go too far with discussing things, we get lost in the discussion. We need to talk about things with each other. We need to discuss some things so that we can understand each other, understand what's going on in the world from each other's standpoint. So we listen and we discuss, and this is a fundamental attitude of selflessness. Just listen. Then our discussion can be useful. But when we become too attached to some idea that we want to promote, or look for some particular way to understand the idea, we can't understand it. We just have to let our mind be quiet and selfless and listen to each other. That way we can understand things. So, no way of being in the world that's going to be perfect. And when we fall into the trap of attaching to various things, some problems will be created. But we should know that whatever we do will not be perfect in terms of good or bad, or right or wrong. It will not be perfect, and it will not please everybody. So we don't insist that we're right. We just choose some tentative way of doing something as a way of being with each other. So by not forcing anything, we are practicing selflessness. So when we are with each other, temporarily we might say, okay, let's do it this way. Okay, let's do it your way. Without saying, no, no, no. My way is best. Just, oh, okay, let's do it your way, temporarily. Tentatively. So, what's known in the world as religion is really us. Religion is us, it's ourself. It's for each of us. Religious feeling. So it's important to recognize superficial ways of doing things, or temporary ways of doing things, or expedient ways of doing things, which are necessary sometimes. But the main point is to practice so that we can find the universal within ourselves. We are all spiritual creatures, we're all religious creatures, and we are something universal. Even though we live our life doing things temporarily or tentatively in order to be together in a very large sangha. So we accept the truth that is always there, the truth that everyone should accept. Then the truth is the same for us as it was for Buddha. The truth for Buddha is the same truth for us. There's no difference. There is no space difference, there is no time difference. The truth is not affected by space or time. What was true for our ancestors is true for us and will be true for our descendants. So we practice here with each other, with many others, and there's many things we do here to keep ourselves organized and going smoothly. Many things to take care of. But we should not forget that underlying each thing we do with each other is our practice. That we manifest through our own determination and our own reliance on our own effort. Are there any questions tonight? Oh, Dave, excuse me.
Les, I don't know much about other schools of Buddhism, Pure Land, and so forth. But I was still surprised to hear that in some of them they regard nature as being essentially sinful, and we need external help from some external source, some deity or whatever, to overcome that inherent sinfulness. I tend to associate that view of human nature and what to do about it with Western religions like Christianity, you know, we're all basically sinful, and God imposes laws, and if we violate them, we're sinning, and then we either are punished in hell, or Jesus will save us, or something. So I was really struck by the fact that there are some schools of Buddhism that seem to share that sort of dark view of human nature. And I guess my question is, does that show up anywhere in the early teachings in the Pali Canon or something, or was that something that was included or overlaid later in the history of Buddhism?
I think it developed in Japan around the same time as Dogen. There were a number of very charismatic teachers who emerged, and they insisted that people really needed to follow certain principles, certain teachings, and not rely on themselves, but to rely on the mercy of somebody else. That was the only way to salvation. And so a couple of schools developed around those ideas.
I guess it puts me in mind of something that Stephen Batchelor said that's always stuck with me, which is that one of the problems with Buddhism is that it's always in danger of degenerating into just another religion.
It's a good point. It's a good point. Thank you. There's always a danger. After the man who became Buddha had his big experience and made his discovery through his own effort, he thought, well, I should pass this along to people. And he said, no, I can't tell anybody this. If I tell them this, they will then depend on my words. And so he said, no, I can't. People are going to have to figure it out for themselves. But according to the legend, he was visited by some bodhisattvas who said, no, for their benefit, you have to go preach. So he reluctantly preached. And of course, since then, people attached to his words, and we have lots of books. So that's the kind of trade-off. He said, here's all my teachings, but don't rely on them. Rely on your own effort. That's the work. Yes, please.
I was just thinking about a story, a little boy who took the worm out of the goldfish, and the master said, shut up to him. And it's like a big thing about in childhood. If somebody tells the child, shut up, and you're doing something wrong, the child listens. So basically, that's what the external help, that's what it's talking about. The external help to understand that you're being selfish, right? Somebody has to tell that. Because when the child did it, child purely did it because that's the worm, and the child found the worm. The child doesn't know that he's selfish, right? The child does not mean to be selfish or what. It's easy to make a child, but many times as adults also, the person who is selfish, and like you said, it takes to arrogance also, does not know, does not believe that he or she is selfish. Because he or she believes that this is the right thing and this should happen at any cost. So many times the self-realization is not very easy, and the selfish person doesn't believe that that is selfish. Like the child didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the child wanted to be selfish. Just did it because that worm, thought of that worm, and wanted to show that worm. But when somebody said, shut up, it dawned.
Liz, weren't you telling us earlier today, that during recess at the school where you are, the boys want to call attention to themselves?
I don't remember saying that today.
Okay. Oh, maybe it was somebody else. Okay. I think it came up in the conversation at coffee. About when you go into the schoolyard at recess, all these boys are always trying to get the other kids to admire them. Okay, well, somebody else.
I do not.
You, okay, it wasn't you. Moment. It wasn't you. Okay. Okay.
That is the case.
Okay, somebody else. Thank you. Yes, please.
Is there a difference between stating a fact and stating a fact pridefully? I ask in part because in the modern world it's very difficult to get away from talking about yourself, but is there a way of lessening the sort of pridefulness element within, like in writing a cover letter, for example?
Can't escape talking about yourself. But is that always pride, or is there some balance there? There are ways, if we need to talk about ourselves, there are ways to do it mindfully and without pride, with some humility. It's ways to do it. We have to be thoughtful in how we say things and our use of the language. One way to do it, you know, is not to take credit for being something or having achieved something, not to take credit, but to say, I really got lucky. I had a lot of help. Others helped me to be where I am. That's, you know, with humility, we don't run the risk of calling attention to ourselves. So there are ways to do it with the right attitude, the right use of language, and a sense of humility. Travis.
What about nonviolent protest? If you essentially you're being selfless, but you are calling attention to a large group of or you, maybe in general the culture is selfish. It seems that that is maybe more true than in Buddhist time, because space and time is the same, but there are many more people, and there is a history of success with conquest, and that may be a type of behavior that doesn't work anymore. So my question is how to culture that's violent, how to make a point that is selfless but gets the attention of people that are desensitized, and does that in a way that doesn't draw attention.
That's the big question. I think we know that if we want to protest something, and we all have a sign that says, you know, we are here to correct an injustice, it would be naive to say that the people on the other side, oh, please tell us. Yes, we're willing to listen. We know that doesn't work. So we say, well, we have to get a little bit more pushy. And it's really unclear. There's no formula. It's never clear how to be in a situation like that, to call attention to the injustice, to motivate people to do something about it without creating upset. We just have to know the situation. We may go with kind and humble attitudes and say, we'd like to talk about an injustice, and the people we want to talk to are so set in their ways, they won't listen to anything. And they will accuse us of all kinds of wrong things, even though we come with a very open attitude. So it's always a difficult situation. There's no one answer for that. I think the word, maybe we shouldn't use the word protest. Shouldn't use that term. Should find another term. Mm-hmm. You know, say, we're going out to correct an injustice. To call it protest already means we are antagonistic. The term itself is, we should find another term. Demonstrators is okay, I think. It's maybe better. That's a good question, and its answer is elusive, I think.
I think it's pretty clear that we live in a culture of egotism, and even, people are often arrogant and bullying, and even in business, as Ayana brought up, when you have to sort of sell yourself, you know, to get a job, you do have to be able to speak about your abilities and your good qualities in a clear way, you know, without being too humble, because in this culture people will think, oh, what a wimp, you know, if you're too,
it's tricky,
you know. And so it's always, you know, it's always difficult, but I think that instead, rather than as Travis was asking about, you know, how do you protest in a good way, I think really what it is that you have to speak up for what you feel is right, and it has to come from the heart. It can't just be and be aimed towards other people's heart, because obviously, you know, there are many ideas about what's right and what's wrong. So it's a matter of feeling something that is true even if it's something good about yourself that you would like to say to a prospective employer, you know, I have done this very well in the past, and I, you know, I would be willing to, you know, work with you, or something like that. You know, find a way to express it, but you have to be able to say that you're good at something. And it has to come from a true sense in your heart that you can do this. And at the same time, in dealing with bullying people, and we all, I think, come across them, even if it's only on the road, you know, driving our cars, you know, you can't reply to bullying with, you know, the same attitude of not, you know, not caring and being arrogant and egotistical. So I think what this practice helps us with is to just be kind of calm and, you know, accept what somebody offers without, you know, without fighting back, but resist it if it is something that we just, you know, we can't in all good conscience, you know, be silent about. So it's kind of an interesting push-pull that I think we all have to navigate on an everyday basis, because we live in a country where people really can be very brash and arrogant and egotistical. So we have to find our ways to be who we are and perhaps have some influence in our own little family circle, in our community, and, you know, hopefully that will radiate outwards. So that's just some thoughts on that.
Yes, Anna.
If someone catches a thought of I'm being selfless, should they then probably change the action, or is it usually always just arrogance and they need to change their way of thinking?
If they catch a thought of...
If they catch themselves thinking I'm being selfless,
oh,
should they usually change the action they're doing, or just change the way of thinking because they're being arrogant?
If somebody becomes aware that they're promoting or being proud of the selflessness, it means there's a practice present there. Just the awareness of that tendency that, I'm calling attention to myself, I'm feeling pride. There's practice there. And that practice itself will provide the motivation for seeing things another way. It's when we don't notice it, then there's no practice there. There's just the continuation of being proud of ourselves. Proud for being selfless, or proud for being something else. That's where conscience comes in. It sort of arouses us that that's not the best way to be.
Is selflessness mindless?
Mindless? No. No, it's mindful. It's mindful. It's selfishness that's mindless. Yes, please.
So the point was made earlier that a lot of times when we're being arrogant or being destructive or acting in some way that's very unskillful, we don't realize that we're doing that. We have these blind spots, these biases that sort of obscure our self-realization. and our, just our self-knowledge. So, I mean, and sometimes we're lucky enough to have somebody tell us, you're acting selfishly or you're acting arrogantly, like the child with the fish was told to shut up. But sometimes we're not. Sometimes there's nobody around, and the burden of doing something about it is us, is to uncover those blind spots. So my question is really, is there a way in Zen practice, or what's the skillful way, most skillful way, to sort of remove these blind spots, our biases, and realize what we're doing that is unskillful or arrogant or destructive in a way, and then correct it? What's the best tactic in Zen practice of doing that?
You sit every day? Thank you. Dave.
Just to briefly follow up on that whole idea of how to present yourself without falling into the trap of like arrogance and self-promotion. Just this last Saturday, we had a guest speaker, Troy Williams, and he told us about an episode in his life which has to be, in some sense, the most extreme version of presenting yourself in an effective way, which was when he was in prison at San Quentin and went before his parole board. And he was very clear on what he did. He said he was there to speak his truth, the truth about himself. And he was specifically not there to say what he thought they wanted to hear. And I think that's one of the key differences to keep in mind. You're not trying to manipulate somebody by saying what they want to hear. And of course, the members of a parole board are probably the greatest experts in the world about detecting when somebody is saying what they think they want to hear. And by speaking his truth, that's how he got paroled and got out of
jail. Good.
So it's not always a question of just selling yourself short and shooting yourself in the foot, because after all, you're expected to go out and treat your own horn. If you tell your truth, you may get out of prison.
Thank you.